Hello, I'm Becca, the owner of Meet Cute Romance Bookshop, and this is the Meet Cute Book Pod. Today, we're talking about book bans. What are they? Where are they happening? Why does it feel like there's been such a dramatic increase in challenges to books in the last few years? And most importantly, what can we do to fight them? I'm no expert, but fortunately, I was joined by one. Philomena Polifrone, she, her, is the Advocacy Associate Manager at the American Booksellers Association, or the ABA, where she is a point person for free expression advocacy, manages the ABFI Free Expression Instagram and Facebook accounts, and led the creation of the ABA Right to Read Toolkit. She holds a PhD in English and Comparative Literature from Columbia University, where she taught courses in writing, literature, and political philosophy. When she's not reading or advocating for free expression, diverse books, and LGBTQ+ rights, Philomena prefers to be found knitting in Brooklyn, flanked by her beloved cats, Starbuck and Boomer. Philomena was a joy to chat with, and we covered a lot of ground. I hope you'll find our conversation interesting and informative. And now, through the magic of podcasting, my conversation on book bans with Philomena Polifrone. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm so excited to have someone here to chat with about this really important issue in the world of books.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can you, first of all, just tell me what is your current position at the American Booksellers Association?
I am the Advocacy Associate Manager at the American Booksellers Association, and I'm kind of the point person for our free expression advocacy. And that means I run the ABFI social media, which is at ABFI Free Expression. And I put together education resources like our Right to Read Toolkit that we released in the fall. It's free online. And also I do a lot of direct organizing. So if there's a bill that I'm worried about, if there are big school board challenges that we think we might be able to mobilize people to combat, I'm in the emails, in the DMs, like trying to get people where they need to be to make a difference.
And what is your background in books or free speech work? How did you end up in this position?
So on the book side, I'm a former bookseller. My first job as a bookseller was when I was 15, technically old enough to work for some reason in the state of Pennsylvania, outside of Pittsburgh. It was this little like combination bookstore coffee shop called the Bookworks Cafe. It was a total passion project, did not make money. I balanced the books and did inventory by hand. It was ridiculous.
You balanced the books when you were 15?
I mean, it's easy to balance the books when two people come in for the entire shift and don't buy anything. Like I said, it was not a money-making venture. But then much later, I was at a very different bookstore in like 2013. I was at the Greenlight bookstore in Brooklyn. And that's where I actually was a bookseller for a little bit. And then after that, I got a PhD in English and Complet from Columbia, where I worked on literature and activism in the 20th century, mostly American fiction. And while I was there, I taught literature and political theory. So this job is kind of combining those two things. Like while I was teaching political theory, I got really interested in the power of people being exposed to ideas and perspectives that they'd never heard of. Kind of working with students in real time, thinking through things that they disagreed with, but maybe not in the way they expected, or maybe liked something more than they thought they would, or just are thinking about something differently. And from there, I got kind of interested in the question of like, how do you build a culture of accepting difference that can support political changes to actually enfranchise people with different backgrounds? And that's really personal for me. I'm a trans woman. Books have been hugely essential to my own journey of self-acceptance. And I just like wish that I had had better books when I was growing up. And I wish that for like queer and trans youth now. So yeah, it's kind of like taking all of those different pieces of my background and shoving them into one role.
Incredible. Yeah, you are very qualified for this job.
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways I've made the job more into something that fits me, but I'm really enjoying it.
Let's talk about book bans, which is a buzzword I am hearing a lot of and certainly hearing about a lot more than I used to. When we talk about banned books, What does that mean? There's not one big list nationally of banned books, right?
Correct. So in terms of what is a banned book, I like to use PEN America's definition, which is that it's any direct or threatened action that removes or restricts access to a book that was previously available in a certain context. Because of that action, it's no longer available in that context. So, for example, there used to be this book in a school. Parents come in and complain, usually a small number of parents. Most of the others aren't paying attention. And because of that pressure that they put on, the book is taken out. That's a ban. Yes, you can still get it at your local independent bookstore in almost all cases. Yes, you can still, I don't know, maybe you can even get it at the public library still. But because it was available in a certain context where access has been taken away or restricted, that counts as a ban. So people like to make this argument that no books are banned in the United States. Okay, maybe we don't have national bans on books, but that doesn't mean that they're not banned. They are banned in certain places where they were previously available. And to your other question, is there one master list of banned books? No, I mean, this is a patchwork of books that are banned in certain contexts where they were previously available. So for example, certain school districts will ban books. Unfortunately, there is a law right now that HB 29 in Utah that has just passed the Utah legislature, really hoping the governor vetoes it, that would say that three school district book bans could lead to a statewide ban in all Utah schools. So this is an escalation. It's not something that we've seen before. And we can see the other sort of thing that I would want to push back on when people say no one is banning books. Okay, to the extent that that's true, it's because we've been successful in stopping them. They're still trying to ban books. It's like saying, you know, you're not getting wet because you have an umbrella, so you can do away with the umbrella because you're dry. It's no, you need the umbrella. That's the thing keeping you dry. So there's a lot of misinformation out there, but that's what I would say about how to define a ban in a way that actually captures the reality of the situation.
So book bans are more of a patchwork system, which is interesting, right? Because it makes it both easier and harder to fight, because you can't sort of, you can get a book unbanned maybe in one location, but it might be banned in a lot of other places. On the other hand, local buy-in and advocacy can have a big effect in a world where it's just a few parents in one school district. So if it's not one national thing, where are book bans happening in the country?
So they're happening everywhere. And I don't mean that they're happening in every single school district, but I mean that you cannot pick a state and say there are no book bans there. In New York, yeah, maybe not in the heart of Greenwich Village, right? But elsewhere in New York State, absolutely. Right outside of LA, Chino Valley, one place where there have been a ton of book bans. That said, there are some states that have been especially ban happy. Texas has a ton of them. There are state laws that are friendlier to book bans. Same thing in Florida. Governor DeSantis has been leading the charge on banning books, especially books that are representative of marginalized groups like LGBTQ plus folks, BIPOC folks. Books about people with those experiences are being banned in droves, more so than other similar books. In terms of who is doing this, it is usually a minority view in a given community. So oftentimes it will just be one parent who is challenging, in some cases, hundreds of books. One resident in, I believe it was Elkhorn, Wisconsin, just this month, she challenged them last year, but then the challenges were sort of worked through as of this month, challenged 444 books in a given district. She didn't even have kids in the school, if I'm remembering correctly. And in some cases, you don't need to, because if you hear something, true or not, about what is happening in a school library, or you read something on the internet about what's happening in a school library, then you can go in and challenge these droves and droves of books, which often is going to cost that school district tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars, in paying staff to review all those books in order to litigate the challenges. So the statistic that is, I still find shocking, even though I've thought about it so many times, is that 60% of the challenges, I think it was in 2022, maybe 2023, 60% of those book challenges were the result of 11 people challenging books everywhere that didn't have a good policy to prevent it.
That is so wild.
It's wild. It's a kind of tyranny of a very small number of people who do not represent the will of the majority, inflicting their will on the majority.
When people are submitting books for ban consideration, presumably each institution that they're submitting to has its own system, each school, et cetera. But what are they submitting? Do they have to justify the reason that it should be banned? Is it just like, hey, take a look at this one? What do they do?
Yeah, you're right that it is a different process in different schools and different institutions. For the most part, that's not necessarily a bad thing in itself, right? Communities should have control over their own statutes and policies, right? The problem happens most often when there is no policy and or when there's a policy that is really vague and allows people to just sort of say like, we don't want to deal with this. We're going to pull this off the shelves. In some cases, there are policies that maybe are specific, but have some other problems. Like, for example, maybe they'll use certain online tools like Booklooks, which is a list created by a former Moms for Liberty organizer that collects all the things they think are objectionable about certain books and tells you the passages that you should cite or read aloud in a school board meeting or whatever. Sometimes the policies will say, we're going to take the book off the shelves while we go through the review process, which is a huge problem because that's going to attract book banners like moths to the flame. They're going to say, well, we can get this banned temporarily, so we might as well challenge it and just challenge anything they don't like. In a lot of cases, what people are picking to weigh these objections or to sort of try to get these books banned are passages that are taken out of context that usually describe something that is or seems sexual in nature. In many cases, what they will do is they'll take a book that maybe the point of which is to have people who have dealt with sexual assault or have dealt with some kind of harassment or bullying or something like that. A book that is meant to help those people make sense of what happened to them. They will take a passage from within that book, read it out and say, this is perverse. This is pornography. The purpose of this book is, quote unquote, prurient interest, meaning some kind of sexual interest in something, right? And because they do that, if they're saying this to a school board who hasn't read the book, the school board can, whether they are happy to go along with this or not, can come away with the impression like, oh, this book is horrible. This should not be on the shelves. But then actually, you zoom out and the thing they've taken a passage from is Beloved, is The Bluest Eye, are these amazing, heart-stopping works of American literature by Toni Morrison. And you're saying, you're calling this pornography? Give me a break. What's happening here is things being taken out of context, cast as pornography that are not, and that are actually parts of works that are meant to support the people who are claimed to be hurt.
And you touched on this earlier, but can you talk a little bit more about what kinds of books are being most challenged? What readers is this affecting the most?
Yeah, so for the most part, in terms of like what age categories, the vast majority of these are targeting either YA novels that are maybe like YA new adult novels somewhere in there, or they're challenging adult novels, not as in like adult content like porn, but, you know, just like adult titles, not specifically YA or children's books that tend to be in school libraries. So that can include something like Slaughterhouse-Five or Beloved or, you know, all of these amazing works of literature that are classics, but, you know, deal with a full range of human experience, including sexuality. a fair number of children's books are being targeted as well. But when we drill down into across all of the different age categories, the groups that are being targeted are twofold. One, 30% of challenged books in the 2022-2023 school year had BIPOC characters or themes or dealt with race or racism. Another 30% had LGBTQ plus characters or themes or dealt with issues of sexuality and gender identity. And if you look at, if you take those percentages and put them alongside like the percentages of books actually published in a given year in those categories, it vastly outstrips it. It's vastly disproportionate. So the reason that that happens is because there are laws in, for example, Florida that are restricting school libraries or public libraries in some cases, ability to teach what are called divisive concepts. Divisive concepts includes like the existence and harms done by slavery in the United States, or the existence of transgender people, or all of these things that maybe people will rather ignore rather than have taught in schools. And so because of that, what's happening is that books by and for and about these marginalized communities are being essentially banned from schools and in some cases, public libraries.
So it feels to me like this is something that I used to think was more of like a historical problem. And recently I've been hearing about it a lot as a contemporary problem. Is this a perception thing? Has there been an increase in efforts to ban books in the last 5 years?
Absolutely. And it's specifically since 2021. And what happened in 2021 was several fold. One, the pandemic. The pandemic took education online. It meant that parents who were maybe getting a little more of their kids than they wanted to pretty much all of the time also were getting a different view of their education and were maybe understanding that like the nature of education had shifted a little bit, that there were things like social emotional learning, which is a great thing, or there that, you know, the works that were being assigned were much more diverse than they used to be, which is also a great thing. But the combination of that and the general sort of conspiratorial atmosphere of 2021 resulted in groups like Moms for Liberty forming and starting this big lie, which is that librarians and teachers and booksellers were handing out pornography to kids. It's not happening. It's never happened on any kind of scale. And this is a lie that was specifically created in order to start this process of banning books on the scale that they've been banning them. Groups like Moms for Liberty, No Left Turn in Education, et cetera, formed and found parents in different school districts who, yeah, maybe didn't like the political bent of what was being taught or just didn't like the diversity of it. Or, you know, maybe some of them had legitimate concerns that were in some cases, well, in most cases, taken by Moms for Liberty and turned into this kind of vast conspiracy of educators and librarians to poison the minds of the youth. And Moms for Liberty, especially in the 2021-2022 cycle of school board elections, really caught people off guard. They were able to sweep a lot of school boards, races that people mostly don't pay that much attention to, suddenly became some of the most important political races in the country, at least in terms of determining the everyday reality of a huge segment of the population. And so with that, districts that had been like pretty neutral suddenly became like the front lines of the culture war. And once the school boards had been taken over, then it was possible to mobilize people, parents, in some cases, even teachers, to these school board meetings to challenge books, to submit formal reconsideration requests to try to get books removed from the library. Before, maybe if a parent had a problem with a book, they would opt their kid out of it. Maybe they would complain to the principal, and it would be an occasional thing that, you know, would be dealt with on a case-by-case basis. Maybe there was something that wasn't age-appropriate. And there is actually a legitimate reason for that kind of challenge, right? Like, let's say that a teacher is teaching something that actually, like, ooh, that's not really right for middle school. Like, maybe high school makes a little bit more sense. And getting another set of eyes on it and kind of going through that process, whatever the decision is, it's good that that is possible. But what happens is when those policies are written so loosely and are able to be used to push radical political agendas, to make it impossible for BIPOC kids or LGBTQ plus kids to see themselves reflected in their school library and the media they're able to consume, then it becomes a huge problem. Then it becomes weaponizable for the sake of bullying and harassing. And that's a problem. And that is what changed in 2021.
Okay. So I am a lawyer, but I am not a First Amendment attorney. People ask me legal questions all the time, and I am not qualified to answer them well. So I'm going to ask you. People come to me and they're like, but book banning is illegal. We have the First Amendment, which says, you know, Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech, which, as most of our Constitution, is very vague. So what is going on here in terms of the legality of banning books in these different venues?
I'm neither a lawyer nor a First Amendment lawyer, but the reason that they're able to have been able to get away with this so far legally is because of some exploitable vagueness in obscenity laws, right? And specifically around this definition of pornography. And this is not something that is like new to the law, right? These obscenity trials have been going on forever. And the test that folks should be using to determine whether something is obscenity or is pornography is something that's referred to as the Miller test. The Miller test is a three-prong test for obscenity that comes from a 1973 case, Miller versus California. And there are three parts to it. The first is whether, quote, the average person applying contemporary community standards would find a work taken as a whole appealing to prurient interests. So again, sexual gratification. The second prong is whether the work depicts or describes in a patently offensive way sexual conduct or excretory functions, as specifically defined in applicable state law. And you can kind of see how those first two prongs, right, leave some room for debate, for subjectivity, for community standards to be worked out through conversation, right? But the third prong is really important, and this is the part that people are blatantly ignoring right now or just talking their way around, which is the third prong is whether the work taken as a whole lacks serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value. And in an educational context, we could add educational value, right? So people are ignoring that last part of the text and just, again, taking these passages out of context, not considering the value of the work as a whole, and sort of saying like, oh, because we can imagine that this would appeal to prurient interest, that the whole book is pornographic. And it's especially concerning and frankly gross when they're doing that for passages that are describing sexual assault as a way of processing it, as a way of finding some support for it. If you think that is pornography, then I don't not really know what to say to you, because that should not be appealing to your prurient interest. And especially when they're taking something like Beloved and saying that it does not have artistic or literary value, the poor little English professor in my soul just dies a little. It's horrible.
We've been talking mostly about school districts and school boards, which I think is the central place where these challenges are happening. Are we seeing challenges to books in any other public locations?
Yeah, public libraries. In some ways, these started at the same time, right? That the challenges in schools spilled over in the challenges to public libraries. People are making one of two arguments. One, taxpayer funds should not be used to support this. Or two, that children are able to access the materials in public library, and therefore the entire library should be kid-friendly, right? And that's not just for things that like are about sex and in a specifically perhaps prurient way that like, okay, maybe you don't want kids to access those things. For the most part, public libraries do not have those, with some exceptions. But again, think about a public library where you can't find Beloved, where you can't find Slaughterhouse-Five, where you can't find anything by queer or trans people, right? I mean, it's a huge problem. So the other area that is especially relevant to my work is the ways that some of these laws impact booksellers. So there are two laws that ABA is currently challenging, where some of the plaintiffs are challenging these laws in Arkansas and Texas. Arkansas Act 372, Texas HB 900, so-called Reader Act. And the Texas law, the Reader Act, what that would do, if it goes into effect, is force booksellers to rate for sexually explicit content or sexually relevant content, whatever that means, in any book that they have sold or in the past or going forward to a school district. So you're a bookseller. Imagine if you had to apply the Miller test that I was just talking about to everything you'd ever sold. It would take you hours. It would take hundreds of thousands of dollars. And in some cases, the cost of it might outstrip any revenue that you could get from selling the schools.
Oh, very quickly, because the costs of labor are one of the major expenses in running a small business.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a huge problem. And unfortunately, this is a law that we've seen replicated in some places. We're pushing against a similar law in New Hampshire. Several laws like that have been introduced in South Carolina. One law that uses elements of the Reader Act is advancing in Georgia. What's especially ridiculous about that is that we have been challenging this law, and so far it's been going pretty well. I mean, we've had Fifth Circuit judges, federal district judges, in some cases, judges who are Trump appointees. So these are not like lefty activist judges, right? Saying this on the face of it, like this looks pretty unconstitutional. We're going to issue a preliminary injunction to prevent it from going into effect, which is great news. But the fact that they are just ignoring that, they don't seem to care about that and are trying to go ahead with it anyway, is really concerning. And I want to emphasize that the case is ongoing. It is by no means settled, right? But just as a litmus test of how well some of those arguments that this is okay are passing muster, like they're not really passing muster. And the case in Arkansas is ongoing, but a preliminary injunction was issued there as well. It's in the appeals process now. And in that case, the Arkansas one would force booksellers who in many cases, do not have much physical space to work with, are being told that they would have to separate an adults-only section that had anything that fell afoul of the law in certain ways, or that could be considered, quote-unquote, harmful to minors in certain ways. It's just, again, something that a small business, a bookseller without much space, like, that's not something you can do.
No, well, also, as we've been talking about, right, the interpretations of what constitutes prurient interest or what would be harmful to minors is pretty subjective. And so as somebody running a small business, it would be really scary to me to think that I might include a book in an area that is like, I think children, you know, it's a YA, it's a queer YA romance or something, right? Closed door, like very sweet, but it's gay. To have someone then come challenge that is going to be an incredibly onerous burden on me as a business owner, and is would encourage me to just put anything that anyone might think is not appropriate for children over in the no kids section, which would then mean any books that are dealing with, you know, sexuality or queerness, or like, as you said, you know, a book that like a historical that has like depictions of slavery in it would just be swept away from areas where like teenagers might be able to access them.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, zooming out from those two particular lawsuits, like this is what I'm worried about across the board is, even if we are successful, as I hope we will be, in challenging every one of these laws, there's the potential for a really worrying, chilling effect here of self-censorship on the part of authors, booksellers, publishers, agents, everyone throughout the process from author to reader, to censor what they're producing and writing and enjoying and distributing to people and celebrating. And that scares the hell out of me. The idea that even the threat of this, right, could shake the foundations of literary production in that way, because that's going to mean a lack of representation, which is already sorely needed.
So before we chatted, I took to the bookstore Instagram to see if anybody had questions about book bans. And one thing that somebody asked was, you know, sometimes people say that when a book gets banned, that's actually beneficial to the author because it gets the book more publicity and people will flock to buy it because being banned is like sexy in some way. Do you have thoughts on that?
To the extent that that ever happens, I think it is overstated. Even conceding for the sake of argument that that could happen in some cases, that would not be true for the vast majority of authors who find their books banned. You know, you'll get the like top 10, like top 15, whatever banned books in a given year. But think about those, like, you know, the number 110th banned book, right? Those are the authors who are really not seeing any of the so-called benefits of having a book banned. And also, again, I think what is harder to measure is the chilling effect that that could have. Who's the author whose book is passed on because a publisher or agent or something like that is actually like pretty worried about having to deal with the whole book ban thing? That's what scares me.
Yeah, I think that's really important to think about because publishing is a business, right? Like publishers are trying to make money. They need to stay profitable. And so to what extent does it behoove them to tweak or edit out or just not buy a book that they think might be subject to bans? They could just buy a different book. Or if something I worry about, right, is that big box retailers and major booksellers have a lot of say in not only like the cover of the book, but also, you know, what books they stock become really important, the content of those books. And so if Target or Walmart or Barnes & Noble becomes worried about being picketed or targeted for the books that they're stocking, and they're the major buyers from publishers, you know, like as an indie bookstore, we can only buy so many copies. What happens when this bleeds out into major retailers just deciding that they're going to take a step away from anything that might seem controversial?
Yeah, and that is the market pressure that I'm worried about. And whatever bump there might be for like a few authors from appearing on a banned books list, it would be vastly outweighed by that, right? But I do want to say publishers, a lot of publishers are really like leaning into this moment and really doing amazing work in the fight against book bans. Penguin Random House support the AbFi, but they also like, they have this amazing lawsuit in Iowa challenging the book ban law there that so far has also resulted in a preliminary injunction. So a lot of publishers are stepping up to meet the moment in that way. But again, like it's the self-censorship thing. I'm like, who's the author who's going to think twice and maybe not go in the direction that they want to anymore? Or maybe going to cut it out before sending it to the agent or whatever. That's just as scary too.
Yeah, no, I agree. And that's, you can't quantify that. So looking forward, what are your biggest concerns? What are you watching right now that seems sort of like most important?
A few of the bills in state legislatures that I've already mentioned, Utah HB 29. If you're in Utah listening to this, please write to the governor, tell him to veto it. In Georgia, South Carolina, and New Hampshire, clones of the Reader Act. Check out AbFi's Instagram. There's more detail about that there. These, I think, speak to like a larger trend in state legislatures, which is to try to introduce laws that are going to make book bans easier. They're already way too easy. And that one thing that gives me heart is that there are bills in state legislatures in certain states that are pushing back against this, that are trying to make it harder to abuse this system and ban books, especially to ban books by certain people and for certain people. That encourages me. But right now, it's just like, it takes so much work and so much organizing to shoot down each one of these that it scares me.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's why, you know, you mentioned that it's frustrating because your lawsuit seems to be succeeding or in the process of doing well in Texas, but this similar law is popping up in all these other states. And it's because you still have to fight it in every state. And that's an incredible amount of work and just time and money, you know, every time. All right. So what is making you hopeful? There's some laws popping up that are trying to fight book bans. What else?
Actually, a lot makes me hopeful. Like, even despite what I do for work, like, I'm actually a pretty optimistic person. And actually, not despite what I do for work, because of it. Because the process of this work and this organizing has just introduced me to so many amazing people who maybe did not think of themselves as activists, who are suddenly founding an organization in their town to organize in defense of the library, who maybe their bookstore is becoming a community center and an organizing hub for local activism, who are making these amazing read-ins happen. Shout out to Idaho and shout out to Utah, both of whom had these amazing read-ins in their state houses, led by librarians, led by booksellers. It's just actually really inspiring to see so many folks organizing in this way and creating communities out of hardship. And especially some of the young folks who are in high schools, who are getting their first taste of organizing by going to school board meetings and are standing up for their right to read and are marching out and are rallying to support their libraries. I mean, that makes me so hopeful for the future, because they're getting good at it and they're going to keep being good at it.
Yeah. Get them organizing young.
Right.
Something that people have asked us a lot is, how can they support or be part of this effort to keep books from being banned?
I would say that, one, figure out who's organizing in your area. That can be sometimes, you know, follow your state ACLU. Follow, if your state has a PEN America office there, that's a great way. I would also say, if you follow our Instagram that is specifically for our free expression and advocacy, which is at ABFE Free Expression, at ABFE Free Expression, I'm doing as much as I can to amplify what's going on a local level, on a state level, occasionally on a national level when it's relevant. And I'm just trying to repost and amplify everything I can. So I also do weekly roundups. So every Wednesday, I do a This Week in Book Challenges thing, which is basically just going through Google Alerts and a few other capabilities we have to track this sort of thing and just putting them on a map. So you can glance at it, see if there's anything in your area, scroll through if there is.
And it seems like, from what you're saying, that focusing on what's going on near you is a really good way to get involved, because so much of this activity is local, based on local community moors and in local schools and libraries. And so stakeholders are going to listen to people who are local residents.
Yeah, definitely. And in fact, the only people who can do something about a book ban most of the time are the people in the immediate area. So the best thing you should do, which I should have started with, is figure out what's going on at your local school board. If you don't even know what school district that is, if you don't have kids, then, you know, figure that out. Because in most, if not all cases, you as a taxpayer in a certain area have just as much of a right to participate in school board meetings as anyone else. If people who want to ban books are using that, then we have to use that too and have a say in what is going on in our communities. So figure out where your school board is, figure out when their next meeting is. You can usually see the agenda a little bit in advance, and you can just check it and set a Google Calendar alert for yourself to check the school board agenda. Bring some friends, make a time out of it. Be respectful, be direct when it comes up. Speak for the right to read, speak in defense of books and against book banning, because oftentimes, just knowing that not everybody wants a book to be banned can be enough to at least force the formal process to happen, which it always should, but it might not always happen unless it has to.
For people who are lucky enough to be living in communities where there isn't a school board challenge going on, or an issue with their local library not being able to stock certain books, how else can they get involved?
Continuing to talk about it continuing to raise the profile of the issue and do some myth busting using some of what I hope I've been able to clarify in our conversation. I would say continue reading banned books. I would also say that you might be surprised about what is happening in your area, because last week, yeah, sure, I was looking at some challenges in Florida and Texas. I was also looking at some in Connecticut. And that is going to be the case a lot of the time, is that in a given week, book challenges are happening places where people aren't paying attention. So just start paying attention, even if you don't think you have to.
I've seen organizations popping up that are trying to make books that are often banned available, especially to teenagers around the country. There's like a queer library that just sort of went viral on TikTok, other organizations like that. Does donating to those, if you aren't able to like realistically attend school board meetings the way your life is right now, is that helpful?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I would say there are two, you know, you can always donate to the ALA, you can always donate to us, but also like look at state level organizations. Texas Freedom to Read, Florida Freedom to Read are a couple that come to mind.
You mentioned that you have created something called the Right to Read Toolkit. What is that and where can people find it?
Yeah, so the Right to Read Toolkit it's aimed specifically at booksellers. It's free online. You can go to bookweb.org and search for the Right to Read Toolkit. You can also go to our Instagram at abfeefreeexpression, and there's a link to it there and the link in our bio. And what this is basically is a playbook for booksellers to use to support the right to read and fight against book bans in their store and to keep themselves safe while doing it. So it's about event safety. It's about making a good banned books display. It's about some of the myth busting that we've been doing in this conversation. And it's also interviews with booksellers and experts and authors who have done some of this amazing work themselves. So the good news is we're working on a more widely available and a wider interest version of this, which will be called the Right to Read Handbook. And we're hoping that we'll be able to have that in independent bookstores in time for Banned Books Week, which is September 22nd this year. So keep an eye out for that.
Amazing. Thank you for making that. Okay, this has been a little heavy, but very informative and helpful. But before I let you go, could we just talk about a couple of books you've read and loved recently?
Yes, we may. This is the fun part, and this is part of what I love about being an ABA is I'm just surrounded by book people all the time. Okay. Cleat Cute.
I loved
it. So good. You loved it too? I love soccer. I loved those characters. Just the whole arc. Like, if every 4 years you lose your damn mind over the U.S. Women's National Team, you will love this book. I also loved Idlewild, which is this coming of age, this sort of LGBTQ plus coming of age story set in a Quaker school in the middle of Manhattan, which actually exists, by the way. I don't know if the school is named the same thing, but it's actually there. It is one of the funniest things I have read. It is, and also is just doing so many brilliant things at the same time. In August, look out for Casey McQuiston's new one.
Oh my God.
A Pairing. Have you read it yet?
I'm saving it, but two of my booksellers have both read it twice.
Oh, gosh, it is so good. Like, it is. Casey McQuiston got me into romance. I'm kind of a latecomer to romance.
We take all comers.
Yeah.
I'm, like, holding out because the problem is that when you read books so early and you're a bookseller,
Yeah. Then
you're like, I read Cleat Cute, like, 6 months before it came out. And I was like, oh, no, I loved it. And then people were like, hey, I'm looking for like a sapphic sports romance. And I was like, I it's not out yet. Like, I want to give it to you so badly.
Oh, no.
So I'm trying to, because it doesn't come out till August and it'll like break my brain if I'm trying to give it to people for the next like 6 months.
Okay, well, ignore what I just told you for, you know, 6 more months or whatever. But in 6 months, it'll be great.
I'm so looking forward to it. Philomena, thank you so much for chatting with me. I learned a lot. I hope everybody else learned a lot. I really appreciate all the work that you're doing.
Thank you so much. And thank you for having me. It's so much nicer to talk about this with folks and organize with people instead of, you know, just staring into the void. So I really appreciate the invitation.
And there you have it. A huge thank you to Philomena for all of her work fighting for the freedom to read and for taking the time to come talk about it. You can follow along with the American Booksellers for Free Expression Project at ABFE Free Expression, ABFE Free Expression, on Instagram and Facebook. And if you've been enjoying this podcast, I would so appreciate it if you could take a moment to rate and review it on the podcast listening platform of your choosing. That helps other people find us, and that helps us keep making podcasts. And that's all for this episode of the Meet Cute Book Pod. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm Becca, the owner of Meet Cute Romance Bookshop in San Diego, California, and I hope you'll tune back in for more deep dives into romance writing, reading, and publishing.